He was reaching for his hat and coat when he noticed that the men in the room were trying to stop him, that their faces had a look of panic and their voices were crying in bewilderment. "What's the matter, Mr. Reardon? Why? But why? What have we said? You're not going. You can't go. It's too early. Not yet. Oh, not yet." He felt as if he were seeing them from the rear window of a speeding express, as if they stood on the track behind him, waving their arms in futile gestures and screaming indistinguishable sounds, their figures growing smaller in the distance, their voices fading. One of them tried to stop him as he turned to the door. He pushed him out of his way, not roughly, but with a simple, smooth sweep of his arm, as one brushes aside an obstructing curtain, then walked out. Silence was his only sensation as he sat at the wheel of his car, speeding back down the road to Philadelphia. It was the silence of immobility within him. As if possessing knowledge, he could now afford to rest, with no further activity of soul. He felt nothing, neither anguish nor elation. It was as if by an effort of years. He had climbed a mountain to gain a distant view, and having reached the top, had fallen to lie still, to rest before he looked, free to spare himself for the first time. He was aware of the long, empty road streaming, then curving, then streaming straight before him, of the effortless pressure of his hands on the wheel, and the screech of the tires on the curves. But he felt as if he were speeding down a skyway, suspended and coiling in empty space. The passers-by at the factories, the bridges, the power plants along his road saw a sight that had once been natural among them, a trim, expensively powerful car driven by a confident man, with the concept of success proclaimed more loudly than by any electric sign, proclaimed by the driver's garments, by his expert steering, by his purposeful speed. They watched him go past and vanish into the haze, equating earth with night. He saw his mills rising in the darkness as a black silhouette against a breathing glow. The glow was the color of burning gold, and Reardon Steel stood written across the sky in the cool white fire of crystal. He looked at the long silhouette, the curves of blast furnaces standing like triumphal arches, the smokestacks rising like a solemn colonnade along an avenue of honor in an imperial city, the bridges hanging like garlands, the cranes saluting like lances, the smoke waving slowly like flags. The sight broke the stillness within him, and he smiled in greeting. It was a smile of happiness, of love, of dedication. He had never loved his mills as he did in that moment, for, seeing them by an act of his own vision, cleared of all but his own code of values, in a luminous reality that held no contradictions, he was seeing the reason of his love. The mills were an achievement of his mind, devoted to his enjoyment of existence, erected in a rational world, to deal with rational men. If those men had vanished, if that world was gone, if his mills had ceased to serve his values, then the mills were only a pile of dead scrap, to be left to crumble the sooner the better, to be left, not as an act of treason, but as an act of loyalty to their actual meaning. The mills were still a mile ahead when a small spurt of flame caught his sudden attention. Among all the shades of fire and the vast spread of structures, he could tell the abnormal and the out of place. This one was too raw a shade of yellow, and it was darting from a spot where no fire had reason to be, from a structure by the gate of the main entrance. In the next instant, he heard the dry crack of a gunshot, then three answering cracks in swift succession, like an angry hand slapping a sudden assailant. Then the black mass, barring the road in the distance, took shape. It was not mere darkness, and it did not recede as he came closer. It was a mob squirming at the main gate trying to storm the mills. He had time to distinguish waving arms, some with clubs, some with crowbars, some with rifles, the yellow flames of burning wood gushing from the window of the gatekeeper's office, the blue cracks of gunfire darting out of the mob, and the answers spitting from the roofs of the structures. He had time to see a human figure twisting backward and falling from the top of a car. Then he sent his wheels into a shrieking curve, turning into the darkness of a side road. He was going at the rate of 60 miles an hour down the ruts of an unpaved soil, toward the eastern gate of the mills, and the gate was in sight when the impact of tires on a gully threw the car off the road to the edge of a ravine where an ancient slag heap lay at the bottom. With the weight of his chest and elbow on the wheel, pitted against 2 tons of speeding metal, the curve of his body forced the curve of the car to complete its screaming half-circle. sweeping it back onto the road and into the control of his hands. It had taken one instant, but in the next his foot went down on the brake, tearing the engine to a stop. For in the moment when his headlights had swept the ravine, he had glimpsed an oblong shape, darker than the gray of the weeds on the slope, and it had seemed to him that a brief white blur had been a human hand waving for help. Throwing off his overcoat, he went hurrying down the side of the ravine, lumps of earth giving way under his feet. He went catching at the dried coils of brush, half running, half sliding toward the long black form, which he could now distinguish to be a human body. A scum of cotton was swimming against the moon. He could see the white of a hand and the shape of an arm lying stretched in the weeds. But the body lay still with no sign of motion.
"Mr. Reardon?"
It was a whisper struggling to be a cry. It was the terrible sound of eagerness fighting against a voice that could be nothing but a moan of pain. He did not know which came first. It felt like a single shock. His thought that the voice was familiar. A ray of moonlight breaking through the cotton. The movement of falling down on his knees by the white oval of a face. And the recognition. It was the wet nurse. He felt the boy's hand clutching his with the abnormal strength of agony, while he was noticing the tortured lines of the face, the drained lips, the glazing eyes, and the thin dark trickle from a small black hole in too wrong, too close a spot on the left side of the boy's chest.
"Mr. Reardon, I wanted to stop them. I wanted to save you."
"What happened to you, kid?"
"They shot me, so I wouldn't talk. I wanted to prevent..."
His hand fumbled toward the red glare in the sky.
"What they're doing. I was too late, but I've tried to. I've tried, and I'm still able to talk. Listen, they..."
"You need help. Let's get you to a hospital and..."
"No, wait. I don't think I have much time left to me, and I've got to tell you. Listen, that riot, it's staged, on orders from Washington. It's not workers, not your workers. It's those new boys of theirs and a lot of goons hired on the outside. Don't believe a word they'll tell you about it. It's a frame-up. It's their rotten kind of frame-up."
There was a desperate intensity in the boy's face, the intensity of a crusader's battle. His voice seemed to gain a sound of life from some fuel burning in broken spurts within him, and Reardon knew that the greatest assistance he could now render was to listen.
They've got a steel unification plan ready, and they need an excuse for it because they know that the country won't take it, and you won't stand for it. They're afraid this one's going to be too much for everybody. It's just a plan to skin you alive, that's all. So they want to make it look like you're starving your workers, and the workers are running amok and you're unable to control them. And the government's got to step in for your own protection and for public safety. That's going to be their pitch, Mr. Reardon."
Reardon was noticing the torn flesh of the boy's hands, the drying mud of blood and dust on his palms and his clothing, gray patches of dust on knees and stomach, scrambled with the needles of burrs. In the intermittent fits of moonlight, he could see the trail of flattened weeds and glistening smears going off into the darkness below. He dreaded to think how far the boy had crawled and for how long.
"They didn't want you to be here tonight, Mr. Reardon. They didn't want you to see their people's rebellion. Afterwards, you know how they screw up the evidence. There won't be a straight story to get anywhere. And they hope to fool the country and you, that they're acting to protect you from violence. Don't let them get away with it, Mr. Reardon. Tell the country. Tell the people. Tell the newspapers. Tell them that I told you. It's under oath. I swear it. That makes it legal, doesn't it? Doesn't it? That gives you a chance."
Reardon pressed the boy's hand in his.
"Thank you, kid.